is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And if you're looking for hard political talk, try another dial. And if you're looking for hot talk, that's somewhere else too. Here we do stories and only stories all the time, and stories about everything. And we just did the other night top 20 best-selling records of all time, and not subjective, just the best sellers of all time. We ripped through it. It was a whole lot of fun, and we were all surprised at what was there and what was not. A couple of bands had two records in the top 20. Quite a number, actually. The Beatles, Pink Floyd, and the Eagles. And then Garth Brooks was, I think, the only solo artist who had two. Led Zeppelin had two as well. So it was bands accounted for eight of the top 20. Historic bands, which is amazing. And then this one guy, this one country writer, who, by the way, I'm not a big fan of Garth Brooks, and I love country music, but Garth had two as well. So when you get a chance, OurAmericanNetwork.org, it's up there, and you can't stop listening. It's back when, I don't know if you remember the days when VH1 was on, and they would start their top 10 this or top 50 countdowns, and you'd go, oh, no, they just wrote me in. There goes my afternoon. It's only an hour, folks. If you got an hour to kill or you're driving, you can just pop your, you know, you can just cue your and sync your phone up to your display on your car and take a listen. And right now we want to talk about, well, a political issue that's a policy issue that can affect all of us. And when we do policy stories, it's only when it hits the pavement, when it affects you, the listener. And today our field correspondent, Alex Cortez, brings us such a story. One that affects a whole lot of people in the most trying time of their lives.
Disease that takes 15,000 victims a year, yet just 20 patients are selected for a clinical trial.
I said right from the beginning, I said, I'm not a statistic. I'm not a number. I'm a person. My name is Lorraine Heike McCartan.
A year later, the drug shows dramatic results, but FDA approval remains years away.
People die from not being able to access these drugs, and I don't want to be one of them.
But she was.
It was approved finally in February of 2013, and unfortunately, it was too late for two of my friends that I had met along the way.
After months of fighting the FDA to obtain a promising cancer drug, Michaela died 2 weeks ago.
If I leave here tomorrow,
stories and yet the same story. Do terminally ill patients have the right to try experimental drugs? Drugs that the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, hasn't approved yet. We report, you decide.
This is too many places I've got to see.
Diego Morris was a young boy, 10, 11, 12, playing soccer, very athletic. And one day he came home and he told his mom that he had terrible pain in his legs.
You're listening to Darcy Olson, the president of the Goldwater Institute and the author of the book, The Right to Try.
He was an avid sports enthusiast, so mom just thought maybe he had an injury or something. But over a few week period, you know, he kept complaining about this.
My name is Diego Morris, and I'm 14 years old. When I was 11, I was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, a rare bone cancer that not many people get.
They did tremendous research very quickly and were told by the best available doctors in the United States that the only way to save his life was going to be to send him overseas for treatments, which we're talking about almost a year-long period.
My family and I had to move to a whole nother country. We moved to London, England.
So that he could be treated with the most cutting-edge treatment for this particular type of cancer, which has almost a 100% cure rate.
Because we couldn't get the treatment we needed in the U.S.
So this particular drug that Diego Morris and his family had to move for won Europe's gold prize in medicine because it was such a huge advance over anything that had been offered to children before who had osteosarcoma. But here we are 20 years later, and we still can't get this particular treatment in the United States.
Americans can't get it because the FDA won't approve it. And so families like Diego's go overseas to save their loved ones' lives. Diego's family could afford it. Most families can't. These families torment themselves thinking, what can they do? But the FDA says there's nothing they can do. And this just isn't about Diego's particular illness and particular life-saving drug.
This year, about 40,000 women in America with breast cancer will hear from their doctor that there are no treatment options left. But what doctors really mean is that in their toolbox of approved FDA medicines, there's nothing left. But we know, for instance, that there are 22 pioneering breast cancer treatments waiting for the FDA's green light, and five of them are already available in Europe.
If a drug is good enough for Europe, should it be good enough for America?
One of the things that I argued for in the book was something called reciprocity, where if a medicine is available overseas in one of these nations where we are comfortable with the process that they use, unless the FDA can come up with a specific objection in 30 days' time, those things should automatically be available here.
That was our field correspondent, Alex Cortez, reporting on whether terminally ill patients should have the right to try experimental drugs in hope of saving their own lives. We'll continue with the second part of this report after the break. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And again, stories you care about. And when it comes to public policy, only the stories you care about. More after this. Lee Habib with Our American Stories. Last segment, our field correspondent Alex Cortez introduced us to the right to try debate, whether terminally ill patients have the right to try experimental drugs that are not yet approved by the FDA, drugs that have the hope of saving their life. His report left off with families being forced to move to Europe to get life-saving drugs they need, a luxury most of us can't afford. These are drugs that have been approved and safely working their magic in places like Europe and Japan for years, sometimes over a decade, and yet the FDA won't approve them. We now continue with Alex's report, where he asks, why not?
So what's the FDA's argument for not approving these drugs? In her twice-monthly feature for Our American Stories that's titled Women Who Dare, world-renowned journalist and author Gail Sheehy explored this question with Jen McNary, the mother of two boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a fatal disease, but one with a life-changing investigational drug called eteplirsen. One of her sons was able to get on the drug's 12-person clinical trial and has radically healed. The other one wasn't and has radically deteriorated. And he's not alone. Without the drug, 30,000 young boys with Duchenne die, all too early, every single year. Here's Jen's take on why the FDA won't approve drugs like eteplirsen.
I think the argument is that the FDA tends to think in old terms, double-blinded, large, long, controlled, placebo trials.
What Jen's arguing is that the FDA requires 20th century methods that aren't needed in the 21st century, such as clinical trials that are double-blinded, placebo-controlled. This means half of the patients are receiving the drug and half of them aren't. the purpose of which is to see the differing outcomes of folks on the drug and folks not on it. But in a 21st century where we know full well how those without needed treatments naturally decline, is this even necessary?
Running over the same old ground, what have we found? Same old fears, wish you were here.
In a disease like Duchenne, we know the natural history. We know that these boys stop walking between 8 and 12 years old. We know they don't produce any dystrophin at all if they have Duchenne. So we know what to expect. These boys die. They decline and then they die. On this drug, they stabilize. They have a much slower decline at worst. And in some cases, like my son Max, they recover skills. And they stop collapsing and falling and hurting themselves. And they don't use wheelchairs. So it is a very, very easy comparison. If you ask anybody with a child with Duchenne what they were doing at 14 years old, like my son Max at this point, it was not going out and getting dressed on his own, getting on a bus and going to school with no wheelchair all day.
There's an immediate human cost. Everyone given the placebo pills is given a false sense of hope and then die when they need not to. And there's a long-term human cost. As these large, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trials that the FDA requires are often too unaffordable for small drug companies, where much of the innovation comes out of. And even if they bear that cost, many can't bear the cost of the length of the FDA approval process.
It takes about 15 years for a drug to get through the approval process at the FDA.
Leading many to go bankrupt in the process, and leading their drugs to vanish into the dustbins of history. And for the drugs that do make it through to final FDA approval, what was innovative 15 years ago might not be the most innovative possibility today.
The drugs that you're putting in your body in general, for instance, if you have cancer, were developed 15 years ago. Now imagine trying to use a cell phone that was developed 15 years ago. It wouldn't even work today. And yet we're telling people who are dying that these are the only drugs that they can use.
Many will never get to use any sort of life-saving treatment. Leading a movement of folks like Diego Morris, like Jen McNary, and like Darcy Olson to call for this.
What someone with Lou Gehrig's disease will tell you is that the diagnosis is 100% fatal. They can see the end coming. There are no other treatments available. And so they would like the right to be able to try to save their lives. They know that a particular treatment may not cure them. They're the first to know that. They're the first to acknowledge it. They're the ones living with these terrible diagnoses, but they believe that they ought to have the right to try to fight for their lives.
In less than 2 years, this movement has passed laws in 24 states that give terminally ill patients the right, along with their doctors and drug companies, to try experimental drugs that have already passed stage one safety trials, but haven't yet received FDA approval.
When you see the way that these laws are passing through state legislatures, you can see that Americans agree with that. You know, it doesn't matter whether, you know, what your views are on other things. You could be a Democrat or a Republican. You could be old or young. But there is something that we all share in common, which is there's a principle at stake here. It's your life. And for goodness sake, you ought to have the right to try to be able to fight for it.
From the support of Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper,
patients should be able to try a treatment, even though it hasn't been approved, if it's an attempt to save their life.
To the support of Republican North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory.
My own family's had to deal with circumstances where they've tried everything, and I think we ought to give people that decision-making capability on their own.
On why these right-to-try laws have so swiftly passed across America, Darcy Olson compared the stakes to the Titanic sinking and what we would do if we were there.
If you were on a sinking ship and the only lifeboat that was available hadn't been government certified, wouldn't you just say, let's get the lifeboats in the water and we'll work on certifying them later? People's lives are on the line. And while these drugs certainly need more testing, I think everybody agrees with that. What we're arguing is, let's get the lifeboats in the water now. People are dying now. And if it's their last best chance, let's give them the right to fight for their lives.
Reporting for Our American Stories, I'm Alex Cortez.
Great job on that, Alex, and great work, Greg. And these are the kind of stories we love bringing you. And The work that the Goldwater Institute is doing and Darcy Olson is doing is terrific. Her book, The Right to Try, How the Federal Government Prevents Americans from Getting the Life-Saving Treatments They Need, is a must-read. And there was a little interesting story here I wanted to hit you with, because it's interesting how the Goldwater Institute came upon this. And it was from oncologists at the Cancer Treatment Center for America. And how that institution came into being is fascinating by itself and quite a story. And then CEO Steve Bonner told the Goldwater Institute this story. He said, "We were founded and are still owned by a guy named Richard Stevenson. He's an Indiana-born and bred kid who then came to Northwestern, got a law degree, and started a merchant bank and had no real interest in healthcare. But then something happened that would change the course of Stevenson's life and the course of cancer treatment for tens of thousands of Americans. His mom, Mary Brown Stevenson, came down with a very serious form of bladder cancer. She tried all the known and approved therapies at the time, but none of them worked. So Stevenson began searching for alternative treatments. He was drawn to try to be helpful as a son, and he looked all over the world for therapies that might be helpful to his mom." Bonner said, "He found a number of promising things around the world and brought them back to her bedside and was blocked there by the FDA and the AMA and by the insurance companies. And she died never having had a chance to avail herself of innovative therapies. Richard Stevenson's mother was denied the right to try to save her own life. The therapies," Bonner says, may not have helped her, but why shouldn't she have had an opportunity to try some of these things? The experience inspired Stevenson to found Cancer Treatment Centers for America. He wanted to create an organization that was focused truly on the patient and that everything would flow from that," Bonner explained. "Now, decades later, cancer patients still face the same dilemma that Mary Brown Stevenson faced. They're being denied access to innovative treatments that could potentially save their lives. It turns out there are currently more than 20,000 FDA trials for cancer medicines and treatments in phase 2 and phase 3, which means they have all passed basic safety tests and many had shown efficacy in patients. But unless the drugs are already approved for another indication, it is unlawful for oncologists to use those medicines and treatments outside of those carefully controlled clinical trials because they are not yet fully FDA approved. Today, about 40% of cancer patients attempt to enroll in clinical trials, but only 3% end up participating. That's just tragic. Worse still, the FDA takes as long as 15 years to bring a new medicine to market. Americans are now waiting 60% longer for the FDA to approve life-saving medical devices, such as stents and valves, than we did only 10 years ago. So, what a story, folks. Innovations keep going and growing faster, and the FDA just keeps going slower. 20th century bureaucracies, 21st century innovations, and it all means something to the dying members of your family. Right to try here, folks. Look into it in your state. And the book is Right to Try by Darcy Olson. Thanks, the Goldwater Institute. Thanks, Alex, and thanks, Greg. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
Look across at smiling lips that warm my heart and see my morning sun. And if that's not loving me, then all I gotta say. Oh, God didn't make little green apples. It don't rain in Indianapolis in the summertime.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. No such thing, and that was such a huge hit for O.C. Smith. The whole country listened to this song, old, young, and what a voice. And what a song. And we're talking about O.C. Smith because, well, every day when we're doing our show pitches and we're gathering around to talk about what we're going to talk about and what segments we're going to do, well, it always goes to food at some point or another. And Hengler's our resident foodie, and he's just, well, he's hung up about so many things, but apples in particular. So this is our off-mic segment of the day.
Casey talks to me about
ratios are everything.
It is. She talks to me about the ratios of burgers because we just moved here from Southern California, and all she did in Southern California was eat In-N-Out burger. Nothing else.
It's a nice skinny burger.
Nothing else to eat. That's the best burger.
Right. And so she came here, and everybody's like, oh, Steak and Shake, it's just like In-N-Out. No. And she says there is nothing because their ratios, the bun to the burger and everything is perfect.
It is perfect.
And she said the Steak and Shake doesn't come even close.
No, it's too thin. It's too thin. But by the way, Crystal's really perfect too. It has really thin buns and really thin beef. And then it has just the right amount of pickle to burger ratio. And then just the right amount of onion. It's really, it's really the ratios. It's why it's good.
Except they copied it. Yeah. It's not even their ratio.
That's okay.
You can have a thick burger, but it's got to be properly seasoned like a meatloaf almost.
Well, that's true too.
Otherwise, you're going to have like this fleshy tone in your mouth that just kind of covering up all the rest of the burger.
But the ratio is, I'm telling you, for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, this is why you cannot have someone else make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for you. Because they'll get the ratio wrong.
That's true.
And it's not just the peanut butter to jelly ratio, it's the bread to the peanut butter and jelly ratio itself.
You can't have too much peanut butter and too much jelly as long as there's the exact amount of peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, but what if you have so much peanut butter and jelly it overwhelms the bread?
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that. I like
that. So you don't matter. You just stack that up.
Yeah. And there's also the matter of crunchy or soft peanut butter. I mean,
I want to understand something. So let's take the burger ratio.
Right.
So you wouldn't mind having like one of those burgers with like a pound of beef.
No, that's disgusting.
That's too much burger for bread, right?
Yeah, we're talking about maybe like a quarter inch, maybe a half inch of a thick of
a
burger.
So what's the maximum amount of like meat you'll take on a burger?
No, I can't stand it when people have like more than one patty of meat. That's disgusting. Unless it's a Big Mac. Big Mac is a different story because it's so thin, and they sneak it in there with that special sauce. You can't really tell that there's two patties.
That's true.
And also, don't they have that one sandwich where they put the bread in the middle, so there's actually three pieces of bread?
Yeah,
two
there's more bread.
That's
right.
Yeah.
But the Whopper, on the other hand, I mean, that's a pretty thick piece of meat, but it's still only about a quarter inch thick, and it's charboiled, which helps with the flavor. So you're not just eating this fleshy kind of unseasoned meat. There's actually some flavor there.
But you don't like those fancy restaurants that go, hey, we got like a half pound of
burger.
Oh, yeah,
and it's like it's
bun.
As thick as
and
my
it's just disgusting. Cell I end up phone with a casing. In half.
Yeah, no, that's disgusting. You want thin.
All right, we settled this.
Well, ratios are everything. I'm just talking about the peanut butter on my apples.
Yeah.
Like even my kids, they're 3, 4, 5 years old, and I have to put the correct amount on there, and I understand. Yeah. Like if you have a big glob of peanut butter on your thinly sliced apple, it just overwhelms it, which goes back to what we were talking about with Chipotle's burritos. Those darn guacamoles that they put on there.
Always gets back to Chipotle.
If they just put a decent amount on and not charge you for it, we'd be in heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
The most important ratio, though, with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches is how much milk you have.
No doubt. It's very
important. You have to have a full glass of milk. And if there's milk left over, I mean, then your wife's going to yell at you because you put the glass of milk back in the fridge. There's like that much in there. But the kids will come through and drink it.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, there's something
or it gets spilled.
The people who leave this much of anything should be shot.
Unacceptable.
They should be shot.
Yeah.
And we know who they are in every household. Because that's me, by the way.
me too.
No, and it goes that way with apples, too. Nobody knows how to properly eat an apple. They eat it. And they leave so much on there, and I'm like, bah! You know, it's just like, it drives me crazy.
Wasted apple.
I've gotten to the point now where I'm in my car, or like if I'm somewhere and I don't have anywhere to put the leftover piece, I eat the whole thing with the stem. I don't care. It's like, I'm just going to eat it all. I don't care what kind of poison they say are in the seeds of the apple. I'm going to eat it all.
Arsenic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't care.
I like discarding my apple cores and my banana peels, because then I can like show my kids when it's okay to litter. Just throw that stuff anywhere you want to. It's okay. It's biodegradable.
Why is there an apple in front of you?
There's an apple in front of you because we're going to do the test. I talked to you guys about the best. This is a test. This is an apple
I'm not even
test.
Sure you still did the dude wipes test,
did
you?
Test?
No, I did. First of all, I don't know if it's necessarily a test because I've tried everything, and this is the best apple you've ever had.
This
is called an Envy apple. This is actually better than that Braeburn I was telling you about.
Well, it smells good.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The envy of all apples, huh?
Balance, everything in it. This apple will not be defeated by any other apple.
Honestly, I can't tell much of a difference between this apple
and
most.
Yeah, maybe you just haven't worked up a...
It's a great apple.
A refined palate for apples.
It's a perfect apple.
And that's a great apple, I got to say. That's
very
a great
sweet.
Apple.
It is. It's just...
Got a nice texture.
Too much of anything. Like the Granny Smith, it's just too sour. This has got a perfect balance of everything.
Mm. Is there more money?
It's, well, right now at the store, it's $2.99 a pound, but a couple of days ago, it was $1.99, so you just got to stock up when it gets
so done. Is this the food that you can just not stop eating? Is that your food? Because we all got food we can't stop eating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this one is dangerous, especially because, okay, I used to do almond butter, but now I do sunflower seed butters because my daughter was allergic to peanuts for a while, so we just cut it out for a few years, and so we started to put in sunflower seed butter. And then so I started to eat it, and I'm like, wow, this is really good. And so now I've just completely switched over, and she's back to peanut butter.
Can you eat so much that you get sick? Like when you eat that extra apple, when you go, why did I do that to myself?
You know what? I never, ever get sick just the way I eat. But I get to a point where I feel a little like a little brick in the stomach. And it always happens from having too much apples and sunflower seed butter.
Like, so you can never have too much. So I mean, as far as like weight wise, I'm trying to shed some pounds myself.
Yeah.
But you can eat apples all day long and the sugars aren't going to add up like
Exactly. Because you guys had brought up the sugars in the apples that, wow, that's a lot of sugar.
Right.
But the whole idea, and this is the whole reason why juicing is so ridiculous, is because that's going to make your insulin spike to heaven. But if, as soon as you keep the fiber in your fruit and you don't extract it and make it juice, that fiber is going to help balance out and your insulin isn't going to go through the roof. And that's what makes you get overweight. That's what takes those carbs and throws them right into your stomach.
Right.
And so, especially too, because I'm putting the sunflower seed butter on it, that fiber is helping that all that fat from the sunflower seed butter too. And so it's just a really good, and that's why I stay away from starches. Like, pastas and potatoes, because that's going to shoot your insulin right through the
it's
roof.
It's so hard to stay away from pasta, though. I mean, my wife makes this fettuccine that you could die for. I mean, it's what about rice, though? Because I like jambalaya.
Yeah,
is this bad?
That's pure. That's going to shoot. I stay away from rice, but I wouldn't discourage other people to stay away from it. I wouldn't discourage other people to. I would just try to lean them in the direction of like a sweet potato, and even more. I would say if you can.
Yeah.
Completely switch over to butternut squash.
Ugh,
butternut squash disgusting. Is amazing. Ugh. If you put a little brown sugar and stuff on
there was two foods I never had to eat as a child. One was peas and the other was squash.
Oh, it's good.
So I guess you have nothing to say about my, because you have the 12 apples. And when I'm sitting down with a really special assortment of Crystal Burgers, I like the first four or five I get through, I'm feeling fine. But it's that sixth and that seventh.
Yep.
But I have friends who can just plow through a dozen of those. A dozen of those.
I could do that.
Oh,
we drove by Crystal the other day and Casey even said to me, "What's Crystal?"
No, don't go in.
It's a knockoff company.
Not go in.
I haven't been in one of those places in a while.
Very good.
Yeah.
Not so as good
what do you guys think? I mean,
it's a very good apple.
That's a great apple. I mean, I'm not. I can't go hysterical over the apple because
so
I'm
excited.
Not an apple guy like
right, right, right.
But it is. It's better than any other apple I've ever had.
Yeah, it's incredible.
No question.
Envy. One to ten, probably a ten.
We're accepting sponsors for Envy.
We'll do that. This is very good.
It is.
Well, there you have it. Our off mic segment. Now you know what we're really obsessed about. We could actually sometimes spend an hour talking about our last meal, the meal we're about to have, our favorite food, and I know you love food too. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, our off-mic segment of the day. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear all of this, the silliness and the serious and the sublime. More after this.
This is Alex Cortez with Our American Stories. We're now back with someone we just like to talk to a lot. His name, Steve Goldberg. Now retired, he was the chairman of the Department of Sociology at City College, City University of New York, for 20 years. And he is the foremost expert on patriarchy, authoring such books as The Inevitability of Patriarchy and Why Men Rule, the definitive in sociological and anthropological studies on the subject. Steven, thanks so much for being here with us.
My pleasure.
And so, Steve, why are we talking about IQ today? How did you choose this subject, and why does it pique your interest?
Well, it is probably the best predictor of success. It's what people, the man in the street, recognizes is, hey, somebody is smart, they tend to do better. The IQ test is basically a test that measures intelligence. People will argue about what is intelligence. It's not all that difficult. Intelligence is an ability to deal with abstractions. And as I say, the man in the street knows some people are more intelligent than others, and the people who are more intelligent, statistically speaking, tend to do better. They tend to do better at school. Any teacher knows that the best students tend to be the smartest students. In work life, the smarter people tend to do better. Now, clearly, this is statistical. There are smart people who don't do well. There are people who aren't as smart who do well. But generally, smart helps. And the IQ test is a test that tends to measure that. If you were to take the next 20 people you met and spend 5 or 10 minutes with each of them, random people that you met, and just assess in whatever way you want how intelligent they are, how smart they are, and you then gave them an IQ test, you would find a very high correlation. The one that you just intuitively said was smart tended to have higher IQs. The ones we said, well, they're not that bright, they tended to have lower IQs. Now, intelligence is not the same thing as creativity, and people often confuse the same thing, those two things, particularly since the word genius is usually used incorrectly in both cases. It means either a high IQ or a people who is creatively a genius. They're not the same thing. In fact, there are many highly intelligent people who are not very creative. But there are very few highly creative people who are not highly intelligent. In other words, a necessary condition for being highly creative is you have to have a high intelligence. But you can have high intelligence without being highly creative, and most highly intelligent people aren't particularly highly creative. Now, what some people argue, they will say, well, look, among my friends, there's not that much of a relationship between IQ and intelligence. Even if assuming they know what their friends' IQs are, the reason there isn't is because your friends tend to have similar IQs. So you filter out that variable. The same thing is true. People will say, well, look, at a good school like Harvard University, there's not that much of a relationship between IQ or SAT, which is roughly like IQ, between IQ and grades. That's true because to get in, you have to have the high IQ. So that, in other words, you filtered out that variable. If, on the other hand, you go to a religious school where people go for other reasons, so you have some people who are very intelligent, some people who aren't that intelligent, that it's not selecting just for intelligence, you'll find that the relationship between IQ or SATs and grades is very high. And it's what people all know. Some people are smarter than other people, and by and large, they tend to do better. And interestingly, you don't even have to, when talking about IQ, have to talk about intelligence. You can just say IQ test correlates highly with success. Success at school, success at occupations, whatever. Now, the reason it does is because intelligence is what it's measuring. But you really don't have to get into that. You can just say it's a test that basically is testing for success in various areas, and it does so successfully.
Is there any exceptions, though, to this, Steve? It sounds rather depressing for me as someone with not a very high IQ.
No, I doubt that. For people often say, I've heard college professors say, Professor Smith down the hall, he's an idiot. Professor Smith isn't an idiot. He may not have as high an IQ as some other professor does, but basically, if you're a professor, you have a fairly high IQ, not necessarily that high. If you have your job, you have a relatively high IQ. And of course, it depends what you mean. Are there exceptions? Like, are there low IQ people who are mathematicians? No. To be a mathematician, you have to have a quite high IQ. But in other areas, there are actors who have very high IQs. There are actors who don't have very high IQs. So there are exceptions. All of these things are statistics. The example I always use is when we say that men are taller than women. You're not saying there are no tall women. There's a woman who's 7 foot tall in China. But nobody's going to say, well, because there's that woman, then men aren't taller than women. We understand when you say men are taller than women, you mean statistically, on average. Well, the same thing is true with IQ, that there are people who are exceptions. There are people who have lowish IQs but are successful, but not a lot of them. Basically, the smarter you are, the better you do. I know some people find that depressing, but if it weren't that, it would be something else. There's going to be something that's responsible for success, and that tends to be, to a great extent, other things are too, certainly. Poverty plays a role, the family you're born into a role, but basically, intelligence plays a very important role.
And how about men and women? Do they differ at all in IQ?
Well, that's interesting. On average, there's no measurable difference between men and women. They have the same IQ. However, the range or the spread for men is much greater, which means that the lower, the least and the most, and this is true most anything you measure, the least and the most is greater for men than it is for women, even though the average tends to be the same. And that's why, now in mathematics, there's a real difference. Males tend to be better in mathematics. But even in other things, where women are just as good as men are, the ones who will have most of it and least of it will tend to be men, though the average for the two will be similar.
Well, this sounds rather sexist of you, Stephen, to say that women can't achieve as great of heights as us men.
Well, I mean, it may sound sexist, but the truth is, if you look at mathematics, I can only think of one female mathematician who'd be in the top 100. If I had to name the top 100, I've written a math book recently. If I had to name the top 100 mathematicians in history, there's one, I mean, another, a woman who was a great mathematician, there would be only one. Now, feminists will say, well, that's because they would dissuaded from being, but no, the evidence is not that. It's that males are better than that. It's interesting how times change. 40 years ago, it wouldn't have bothered anybody. No woman was saying, all right, so males tend to be better at mathematics. So now that's become a big thing. And I would certainly say that for any woman who wants to be a mathematician, who has mathematical ability, should be encouraged. But then you will also hear people, well, 85, 90% of the college professors in math are males. Well, that's the way it is. And it's because males basically are better. When there's a woman who is that level, she certainly should be encouraged. But the idea that there should be equal numbers in mathematics, it's silly, because it's they're not the same. Men and women are not the same in mathematics any more than they are in height.
And we get the lower lows, so it isn't all positive either. We have a friend in studio today, Stan Dye. I wanted to cue him in case he has anything to ask you about, too.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Oh, we just have a friend in studio today named Stan Dye who might have a question to ask you as well.
Oh, sure.
Hi, Professor. We're Alex and I were just shooting the breeze earlier. We're saying now we're talking about IQ, intelligence, but how much of that is really just tied up in income?
Well, that's, of course, a difficult question, because one of the other question is how much of income is tied up in IQ. In other words, do people who tend to be brighter tend to make more money? So you can't just say, well, because somebody comes from a wealthier background, that's why they're more intelligent. It also works the other way. If they're more intelligent, they tend to make the higher income. This is a big argument of nature versus nurture. In the social sciences, there's a tremendous bias against genetic explanations, or against genetics playing any role. So the sociologists will tend to argue, well, it's really a function of poverty and of education. I think the pendulum is switching. It's quite clear genetics play an important role. They play an important role in intelligence. So do non-genetic things. I'm not saying that's the whole story, but it clearly genetics does play a role, and the other things like poverty and education and all, they are more a function of basic intelligence than they are a cause of it.
Now, Professor, what about the so-called Flynn effect, where it seems that, you know, as time goes on, each generation is getting higher and higher scores on the IQ test? So if you rolled it back, it's almost as if our grandparents and great-grandparents were somehow deficient. What's going on there?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and the truth is nobody quite has the answer. Nobody thinks that everybody's getting smarter generation by generation. One answer to the question, and it's a partial, I'm not even saying this is the answer, but it's a possible one, is simply that people get more used to taking tests. Mm. And in doing so, they improve the score. It's not a tremendous improvement, by the way, but it definitely, over generations, there's some improvement. Nobody who studies this thinks that means every generation people are getting smarter. It's that they're doing better on the test, which may mean that the tests become not quite as good as predicting success in academically or professionally or whatever. But it's a tough question. Nobody knows quite why it's getting better, but it's not a dramatic difference. It's not like, well, that shows that IQ is malleable and can be changed a lot. It does change somewhat over generations, but it's more an artificial change than a real change. It's not like, I mean, all you got to do is look at the great minds of 300 and 400 years ago. It's not like we're all that much smarter now. It's really more just we're doing better on the tests, which will have an effect on how predictive the tests are. But basically, they still are predictive.
This is Alex Cortez with Our American Stories. We've been listening to Steve Goldberg, and maybe next week we'll talk about something lighter, like bagels or why Chicago pizza is better than New York pizza. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, we could do that.
This is Our American Stories. I'm Jesse Edwards. Recently, I had the chance to speak with a man who goes by the name of Creed Bratton. You might know him from NBC's hit television series The Office, where he plays a character with the same name. But being on television wasn't his only brush with fame, as you'll hear in this conversation. We talk about his life before and after The Office in this interview. Hi, this is Jesse.
Hey, Jesse. Creed Bratton here. How are you doing, buddy?
Creed, doing great. Yourself?
I'm well, man.
One, two, three.
This is Creed, and he is in charge of something,
that
right?
Is correct.
Say hi to the kids.
Hi, kids.
Yay.
Have you ever seen a foot with four toes?
Yeah. What are you doing? Stop it. Stop it. Just no. Would you cut it out?
Every time that I fall, I also fly.
The song you're listening to is called Move to Win, performed by singer-songwriter and actor-comic Creed Bratton and his band The Rubbermen from his album Audiobiography. Tell me about it. Creed Bratton, he's a really interesting character with a fascinating life story to tell. He was the founding member from the 1960s rock group The Grassroots, and most recently famous for playing the character on NBC's hit television series The Office.
You got to move to win.
Creed, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Jesse. Thanks for having me, man.
Full disclosure before we get started here, I'm such a big fan of The Office. It plays on a constant loop in my house with my family. Last year alone, I watched the thing 9 times from beginning, middle, to end. I've already seen it once this year. So let me just get that out of the way before we get started.
Wow. You're the one that keeps doing it. I have a very young following now with college, and they tell me it's Netflix. That's the reason that they're discovering this show. And who knew? Back in the day, that didn't happen. You know, you got a one shot at it, and they could buy your album or something like that. But that was it. Now they just this phenomenon is occurring. It's pretty amazing.
But before we get to that, I wanted to see if we could talk about your life and your early life and how you got started from the very beginning. You were born in 1943. Mm-hmm. And you grew up near Yosemite Valley, California, and your father died serving in World War II when you were just 2 years old.
That's correct, when I was 2 years old, yep. Uh-huh.
Did you learn anything about him?
I knew that he was a lieutenant colonel. He had the rank of lieutenant colonel. He was one of these guys. He was a liaison working with Northrop Aircraft. He was a military, but it was one of these situations where he worked as an adjunct, you know, with Northrop, too, and he would go up in the planes Wow. In all their planes, and he would sit there or fly them or whatever, depending on what he needed to do that day, and listen to the engines and listen to the struts and stuff, and he could tell you exactly. He built his own plane, I found out.
Wow.
With my uncle. And so he had this amazing ear that he could hear stuff. And unfortunately, he was told this one day when we go up in this plane called the Black Widow. There you go. This was in Hawaii, and he had a really bad feeling about it. He told everyone he really didn't want to do it, and they said, well, you know, this is your job. And he said, okay, but I just don't like the sound of this plane. And he got in and went up, and it crashed on takeoff. And
Was
that, you know. Yeah, yeah. But you know what? There are a lot of crazy. I had a lot of trauma as a child, and I think that has a lot to do with you hear of this a lot with artists, and you either sink or swim, and you become more creative, and you rise above it, or you fall into oblivion, you know, and I chose the former.
So your mother remarried, and you were forced to take a new last name, and you were surrounded by your grandparents would play music, they were in a band, and you were surrounded by music, basically, as a kid. Can you tell us how that began to influence your musical career?
Well, I mean, I would go down in the summers and spend the summers in Long Beach, California, with my grandparents, and they had a semi-professional country western band, western swing band called the Happy Timers. I put them on the cover of my Coarse Gold album, the band. And I would sit there and fall asleep at night behind one of these amps. I hear all the those songs from the 40s and 50s. You know, I heard a lot of classical country songs and standards and stuff, and I loved it. And I played trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
Starting like at a very young age, and I was quite good at that. It was a naturalist that the teachers told me. But at 13, my grandfather started showing me some chords, and then I was able to listen by ear on the radio and hear the chords and progressions, figure it out.
What was your first guitar?
The first guitar I had was a Silvertone guitar that I bought with my own money. And of course, we didn't have any money up there, so I had no allowance, per se. Never. No one gave me. I just had to go and do it. No one gave me a thing, Jesse. I worked for everything. I set away for the, in the Sears, we call it the wish book. You sit there and you stare at this. That was it. That was your big connection with the great world out there was the Sears and Roebuck catalog. I saw this Silvertone guitar. It was made by Dan Electro. And it came, and I'm telling you, I pulled it out of its case. And pulled out, and the cord came with it, and it plugged. You plugged the case was the amplifier. There was a speaker in the guitar case, so you'd open up the case, pull out the guitar, plug in the case, plug your guitar into the case, and you play through the speaker and an amplifier in the cover of the case, and that was your. That's how you played. And I just played that thing out in the barn. With the chickens and the cattle, the steer we had there, and everything we had around the place, and for just a couple of years, solid. Until about 17, I started playing professionally.
This is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Creed Bratton, who starred in NBC's hit television series, The Office. For the next few segments, we'll be talking with him about his life, his professional music career, and his time on The Office. And this is one of Creed's songs called Spinnin' and Reelin'. We'll be right back with more from Creed Bratton. This is Our American Stories.
Everybody knows I'm crazy about you. Just can't stop thinking about my love. My love. I thought I'd never see a reason to feel. But here I stand, spinning and reeling with love. Whoa, spinning and reeling with love. Whoa, given the time, I might come back down. But it feels so good, my feet don't touch the ground. Well, everybody knows I'm crazy about you, just can't stop.
About
I remember how strong I felt as I drove to work that day.
Welcome back to Our American Stories. I'm Jesse Edwards. We're talking with Creed Bratton from NBC's hit television series The Office that ran for 9 seasons. Creed is also an accomplished musician who was a founding member of the 1960s group The Grassroots, who had a number of top hits. The song you're hearing now is one from Creed's solo career called Unemployment Line.
The beat you right down to the ground in Unemployment Line.
The only difference between me and a homeless man is this job. I will do whatever it takes to survive, like I did when I was a homeless man.
So, Creed, can you tell us about your first job growing up?
Oh, gosh, yes. I worked as a paper boy down in Fresno, delivering the papers. I worked as a milk cows. I dug post holes. I shot squirrels for ranchers and stuff.
Sure.
I worked as a dude wrangler for the pretty great school, Johnny Jones Pack Train. We take people, take the dudes back in the high country, and we'd ride them way back in there and set them up. And then I'd take all the mules and stuff, pack everything up, and head back to the camp to take us the next day or the next couple of days. And I was so tired. I was 15 years old when I was doing that. I a couple of times I fell off the horse or the mule, whatever I was riding that day, and you just through the creek or whatever, blah, 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 and get up because you were young and resilient. So, I mean, I had all kinds of different. In college, I had a swim scholarship and a water polo scholarship, but I'd go through class. And then I go straight over and I go right to work cleaning the blackboards, sweeping up the school. And that's how I got through college doing that. You know, so I was never not working. It just was work, but it's all I ever knew.
Sure. After college, yeah. You set out to see the world. You and a friend hitched a ride from California to New Orleans to board a cargo ship bound for Venice, Italy. And after 28 days at sea with only $25 in your pocket, you started hitchhiking around Europe. Tell us where that adventure took you.
Well, my friend Mickey, he got frustrated. He heard his girlfriend talking to a guy he got one phone call. We were up in Copenhagen and we didn't, the first night we were there, he and I got drunk on wine with these people because I didn't have a guitar with me and these people had a guitar. I picked up the guitar and started playing. They all went, "Hey, it's great." So we ran around saying La Bamba and I woke up the next morning in St. Mark's Square covered with pigeon had it all over my head, face and hair and body, and we just looked at each other and started laughing, and it was great. Anyway, he heard his girlfriend's voice talking to a guy, and he freaked out and has asked his parents to send. Now, I had paid his way over because I didn't want to go by myself. I had, in college, I'd worked. As I told you, I played in bands, so I'd saved my money. I'd bought an Austin Healey sports car. That was the pride of my life, except my guitar. I sold that because I was in drama major, and I said, I've got to get out of here. I just see that this life's taking me nowhere. I need something to change. And also, my little voice said, you should go to Europe. Go to Europe. I actually had a drama coach tell me I need life experiences. So one thing led to, I said, come on, Mickey, go with me. I said, I'll pay your way, and I'm going to sell my car. He said, you're selling your car? I said, I'm selling my car. And I sold the car. It was the best thing I ever did in my life because I ended up there. So anyway, he flew home. So I hitchhiked. I didn't hitchhike then. I stowed away on trains.
Wow.
I hid and stayed one step ahead of the what would be called the guy who just walked around trying to bowl and put trying to get you off these trains and stuff, you know. But I managed to do it because I was a good actor. So
yeah.
I was able to act like I belonged there many, many times. And I got down. I got a job in Munich, and then I met these two guys who were going off to Africa. And I joined them. We called ourselves the Young Californians, and I spent about the next 2 years traveling all over Europe, Africa, Middle East, up into Scandinavia, Red Curtain countries. Just went on and on. 145 pounds. I went there with 200 pounds. Went back at 145. I was starving to death, basically.
Yeah. And you eventually, you changed your name to Creed Bratton and you returned to the U.S. and you met up with a group called the 13th Floor, which would later go on to become the Grassroots.
No, I started the 13th with my friend Warren Etner, who I met in Israel. I was working, playing a folk festival there, and he came up to me and liked what I was doing. And, I liked Warren, and, we went to a party, went to a house and played a little together, and I liked him, and so I put, he took his number, and I called him when I got to L.A. This is my first time in Los Angeles since I had been born there. And I had, of course, I'd been down to Long Beach, but I'd never been to L.A. per se, or Hollywood. So I called him with what, as soon as I got there, in 1 week, my girlfriend, Joanna at the time, got us a job playing the strip bar. And that was how we started, the 13th floor. We played for a year, worked ourselves up on the Sunset Strip at the place called the London Fog. And then we got a chance to become, yes, the Grassroots. First song that we recorded with them was Beating Around the Bush, that Warren and I wrote. That was our demo. And the next song was Live for Today. He and I played on that with Al Blaine and a buddy of mine named Bobby Ray.
Yeah, let's listen to that just for a minute. This is Live for Today, featuring our guest Creed Bratton and his band, The Grassroots, from 1967.
I think of all the worries people seem to find, and how they're in a hurry to complicate their minds by chasing after money and dreams that can't come true. I'm glad that we are different, we've better things to do. Let others plan their future, I'm busy loving you. 1, 2, 3, 4
This song jumped the charts back in the 1960s to number 5. What was that newfound success like for you?
Well, it was pretty amazing. You know, I remember driving down Sunset Strip feeling pretty darn good. And I heard one of our songs come on the radio, and it just, all of a sudden I pulled over to the side of the road and just sit there for a while. I kept punching stations. I heard it on 3 or 4 different stations, and I'm sitting there going, my life, this little voice said again, your life will never be the same, and it hasn't been. And that was it. Boom. Open the doors. Open the portal.
So then after the Grassroots, you kind of faded away from that, and you started working in Hollywood. You started taking some professional acting courses, and
right.
you went on to appear in several major motion pictures, working behind the scenes in Hollywood. And years later, you ended up working on with Bernie Mac, and you had a friend who was going to direct The Office. Tell us about that time in your life and how you got to become part of that show.
Okay, well, I had my buddy Joe Moore, who's a fishing buddy of mine, who I used to travel with, I met him on a Disney film and got friends with him and his father, who was a major director in Hollywood. And we all got off together, and we loved to fish for trout. So I told him I had been doing all these different jobs, but I was working for a catering company. It was killing my back. And he said, well, I can put you in as an extra and a background work for Bernie Mac. He said, it won't be as physically hard for you. You know, you can make your insurance too for your medical. So, you know, there's a stigma in town. If you do that kind of work, you're never going to make it as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, I didn't buy into that. I said, nah, I've got the talent. If I do it, I'll do it. And I was still in class, by the way. All these years, every week, I'm working with this group called the Sarah Fulton Group and going and putting up scenes and stuff. So, I was on Bernie Mac. This guy Ken Kwapis came on to direct. I heard he was going to do the Office. I went on The Office with him because my little voice said that's what you're going to do.
Wow.
Left, and I just started getting bits on the Bernie Mac, but I left anyway. And I was there for a couple of weeks on the show, and I saw all these talented kids, and I said I've got to do something to get noticed. So I created the character based on what would happen if I, as a guy from the Grassroots and Rocco, continued debauching and let's continue doing drugs and became illegal, did all this illegal stuff, you know.
Uh-huh.
I amped up the weirdness, shot about an hour's worth of stuff, ad-libbed quite a bit of it too, but got it down to what I thought was the funniest stuff and submitted it to them. And a few days later, line producer came up and he had it, and I think Terry Weinberg had it, and Greg Daniels had the tape.
Yeah.
And he said, my God, you're really, really funny. So all of a sudden, boom, we only shot 6 episodes that first season. Second season, right away, they throw me at this thing on my desk, a script, 6.5 page scene with Steve Carell, the Halloween episode.
Yes.
And that was it. I made my bones on that when it aired. On a Thursday, Friday morning, I was sitting at craft service getting some coffee. I look up, and it's Krasinski and Rain Wilson walking up to me, two of my buddies who were so encouraging to me when I was on the show. And they gave me a big bear hug and whispered to me, you knocked it out of the park, buddy.
And that was the scene in season two when Michael Scott tried to fire you, but you got him to fire someone else because you fought for your position. And you were dressed up like a vampire the entire time because it was the Halloween episode, which was hilarious.
Yep.
This is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Creed Bratton, who starred on NBC's hit television series The Office. We're talking about his life, his musical career, and when we get back, we'll hear more about his 9 years spent on the set of The Office. This song is by Creed Bratton. It's called The Rubber Tree. Keep it right here. This is Our American Stories. We'll be right back with more from Creed Bratton.
Wind it up, bounce back, do the rubber tree. In Indonesia, there's a thousand snakes.
This is Our American Stories. I'm Jesse Edwards. We've been talking with our guest, Creed Bratton, about his life, his successful career in music, and his time on NBC's hit television series, The Office. This music you're hearing now is actually from The Office on the Booze Cruise episode, where Creed is actually playing guitar, where he also talks about being a member of the Grassroots.
Back in the 60s, I was with the Grassroots. We toured with Janis Joplin, The Doors, Cream. We had a lot of fun. And now I do quality assurance for a paper company. As you can imagine, drugs played a part. We still do. My work calls last about 90 seconds, and that's about as long as I can concentrate.
Now, your character in The Office is the crazy old guy who's open about how he likes stealing things. He makes fake IDs for teenagers, and he even forgets his own job title, which was quality assurance.
What do you do here?
Excuse me. What is wrong with this woman? She's asking about stuff that's nobody's business. What do I do? Really, what do I do here? I mean, I should have written it down. Qua something. Quabity Assurance. No, but I'm getting close.
There's also the scene where your coworkers complained about the way you smelled because you were sprouting mung beans in your desk.
Okay, Ryan, you told Toby that Creed has a distinct old man smell.
I know exactly what he's talking about. I sprout mung beans on a damp paper towel in my desk drawer. Very nutritious, but they smell like death.
What was your favorite Creed moment from The Office?
Oh, gosh. I always tell people, there's so many. You know,
yeah.
I've heard that Which One's Pam and Somebody Make It Soup were the ones that put me on the map.
Yes.
That people found. Even the writers said, well, this is hilarious. I did a lot with a little, apparently. So, but the one I really love, I tell everybody, is I was doing a scene with John, and I was asking for a pie. I was supposed to get a birthday. He said, well, you want a birthday cake? He said, I want a birthday pie. And so we're doing the scene, and John says, why don't we shoot it like a David Mamet play, real fast, and boom, 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 boom. And we did it. And that was John's idea, and we shot it close up, and he said he was laughing one time because I was so intense I could spittle coming out of my mouth.
I hate devil's food.
Well, I think Meredith's.
Screw Meredith. I don't think it's fair to let someone else pick the cake on my birthday.
Everybody's birthday.
Today is actually my birthday, and I want to pick the cake.
What do you want?
I want pie. I want peach pie.
You want birthday pie?
I want a nice cobbler.
Well, I'm going to talk to Angela, and we're going to see what we can do about a pie.
I don't care who you talk to. Just make it happen.
It'll be Angela.
You tell her it's for Creed. She'll know what that means.
But as I see that, I saw that for Survivor Man. I saw that the other day somewhere. And I started laughing again because I found that very humorous. There's a lot. Kids come up to me and sprout all the stuff all the time.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
Some of it too, you know. Yeah.
After 9 years on The Office, when the finale finally aired in 2013, I held it together pretty well. Until the final scene when everybody gathered around The Office for the very last time, and you started to play the guitar and sing a song called All the Faces, and I got to tell you, mm-hmm. I completely lost it. Let's take a listen to that for just a second.
I saw a friend today, it had been a while, and we forgot each other's names. But it didn't matter, 'cause deep inside the feeling still remained the same. We talked of knowing one before you've met, and how you feel more than you see, and other worlds that lie in spaces in between, and angels you can see, and all the faces that I know have that same familiar glow. I think I must have known them somewhere once before, all the faces that I know.
Tell us about this song. When did you write it?
I wrote that in 1970. I had left the Grassroots, late 69, I believe, something like that, early 70. I can't remember exactly when, but people tell me different stories. I'm not sure. No one really knows when I left, except the lawyers, I think. But anyway, I'm sitting out in Ramirez Canyon in Malibu. Daughter Ami had to be late 69 because she had just been born, so had to be at least in December, probably around Christmas time, I would think, in 1969. That's right, that makes sense. She's in her bassinet there. Joanna's in the cooking dinner, and I'm sitting by the fire playing my guitar. And all of a sudden, Joanna goes, "That's beautiful. Who wrote that song?" And I said, "I think I just did."
Wow.
And I realized that at that time, this was the first song that came in its entirety, Jesse. It came out, the lyrics, the melody, the chords. And this is like a complicated little, it's simple, it seems simple, but it's an intricate little pattern, all a, kind of like a James Taylor kind of a pattern.
Yeah.
And I realized that then that my good songs from then on have come that way. They just come out of the ethers. And I don't have to think about them, always appear. And I've written a lot of songs like that. The ones I try too hard and think about and calculate, they're okay sometimes, but they're not like all the faces. And and when I played that at the table read for the Universal people, and people were crying even at that time, the cast and everybody. The song now has went viral, and that is my hit. You know, I have Live for Today and Midnight Confession and stuff, but
yeah.
As far as the kids on Netflix know, when I play All the Faces in a Dry Eye in the Big Place.
Well, I can't hear it without tearing up. I got to tell you, it's a beautiful song.
Oh, good.
And I know you got to go.
People miserable.
Just before, I know you got to go, but really quickly, tell us about your tour coming up here. You got a bunch of shows coming up in Houston, San Antonio, Fort Worth, Greensboro. Is that going to be just you, or is that your whole band? How's the show going?
No, I just walk on stage now, and with my little Gibson I have, and my new little guitar, which I love to death, little Parlor Gibson.
Yeah.
And I play my original songs. I do some Grassroots songs. Of course, I'll do All the Faces. And in between, I tell stories and humorous anecdotes. You know, and people seem to be enjoying the show because they keep asking me back to come back again. So I hope this will be in Arkansas. Hope people find me there and come to the show.
Well, you're a class act, sir, and I really appreciate your time with us today. And if anybody wants to find out more about that tour and catch Creed live on tour, you can go to creedbratton.com and check that out. Thanks again, sir, for being with us, and thank you for all the laughs over the years. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. Before I forget, let your people know, for my fans, I have a song out there called Faded Spats, which is the title song from my last album. It's a free download. And they should be able to go and find that song anywhere online.
As we're going out here, let's take a listen to that. And as we part ways, I thank you again for the interview. And I hope we can talk again soon and catch up on some more of your past and your future.
All right. Well, thank you, Jesse. I enjoyed it too, man. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Creed. Take care. That was Creed Bratton with his amazing story about fame and success from the music scene of the 1960s to NBC's hit television series The Office, which first aired in 2005, lasting 9 whole seasons. This is Our American Stories. I'm Jesse Edwards. If you'd like to hear this interview again or share it with your friends, you can get it at OurAmericanNetwork.org. More after this. A golden freckled coated stream.
haven't you felt it? Wanting to get out, what would they make of that? Somebody's calling, you could answer, what would you say to them?
Brother standing by the road with a heavy load from the seeds he sowed. And if you see your sister falling by the way, just stop and say, when you're going the wrong way, when you've got to try a little kindness.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. That's Glenn Campbell's Try a Little Kindness, which means it's time for our generous living segment sponsored by Philanthropy Roundtable, the nation's leader in fostering excellence and generosity, protecting philanthropic freedoms, and assisting givers in achieving their goals. And you can learn more about their work at philanthropyroundtable.org. In Philanthropy, the magazine, I read about a remarkable Chicagoan. Given that our field correspondent, Alex Cortez, is from Chicago, we asked him to chase down this story.
Portrayed him in the movie Hardball.
Oh my God, Tiki. I was down 11 grand before I made this play.
He misportrayed him as a drunken gambler who didn't want to coach inner city kids in a Chicago Little League.
I get paid under the table to coach that team. And I only do that because I'm in a big hole with two bookies who are looking to kill me.
But he wasn't a drunk, what? Or a gambler, or forced to be there. Actually, he was a drunk, just not at that point in his life. By this time, he had already met a man who would change his life forever. The man who inspired him to actually found the Inner City Little League. A man named Jesus Christ. A story they somehow missed in the movie Hardball. But without that story, without that man, there would be no West Side Little League. There'd be no story for Hardball to tell. There'd be no Hardball. Worse to him, they misportrayed all those kids who he made his own, portraying them like this.
All right, let me break it down to you right quick. Andre say he catch any hop of ball anybody can throw. Coffee say that's bullshit. You a buster. Andre say roll up. Coffee say I'll give you all my gun if you catch this ball. He threw the ball. Andre caught it. Andre say pay me my money. Coffee say you do a cheating. No way. Coffee say you a motherfucker.
Okay, I got it. Thanks.
Cursing that he said they never used, reinforcing the worst racial stereotypes. He pointed out, you never see the white kids in Bad News Bears.
If you wiped your nose once in a while, people wouldn't give you so much crap all the time.
Or Mighty Ducks.
You don't even know what to do with it, wuss breath.
Using this language. This man's name is Bob Mazakowski, and this is his real story.
To lead them with strong hands, to stand.
Alcohol abuse at a young age led to drug abuse, and in college it all spun out of control. When Bob would play rugby, he'd hold a cup on the sidelines with cocaine in it. One of the games, he asked a friend, "Hey, that guy who just got thrown out of the game, is he really a priest?" And he was. An Anglican priest named Pastor Weber that became more than a teammate. He became a friend. A friend who tried to help him. But Bob didn't want to think too deeply about his life or about God, saying, "I'd always thought doing so might spoil my fun by making me feel bad." Then rock bottom came. A drinking binge cost him his job and caused him to miss Christmas with his family. And a bar fight led him to prison. Pastor Weber bailed him out, but at home and drunk and high, Bob fell and tore open a wound from the brawl, landing himself in prison. Pastor Weber shows up once again, this time holding Bob's hand in prayer. "Lightning didn't flash," Bob later said, "but it was suddenly as if I had new eyes." New eyes that opened wider over the next few years, leading Bob and his wife Tina to move to Chicago. And just not anywhere in Chicago, into the neighborhood of one of the most notorious public housing projects in all of America, Cabrini Green. Here's a CBS report on the neighborhood from 1989, about the same time they moved there.
Picture a no man's land with broken windows, dark abandoned buildings, no law and order. There are carefully demarcated areas controlled by rival bands of armed militia fighting over the rubble. Nearly every night there's sniper fire. It sounds like Beirut, but in fact it's America.
What's it like here? What's the neighborhood like?
Like a bad neighborhood.
So why would the Muzikowskis move there?
You move away from the city because of the crime, the better schools. I want a nice big backyard. And if you think about that, Jesus isn't even that picture, you know.
Why do all Christians who make X amount of dollars live together with other Christians who make X amount of dollars? Why aren't we mixing with people of other races and of other income strata?
We feel very strongly, where would Jesus live? Or if I, and if you look in the Bible, Jesus was in the cities. Peter, Paul, all of them, they're in the cities where it's happening.
We have friends who won't visit us down here.
Is my car safe out here? Or no, just me and my kids, we're safe. You guys aren't. You're ready to get back and go to the suburbs.
For Bob and Tina, it's about going all in on their beliefs.
Tina's not from this background. She just really must really believe the scripture.
Do not fear is in the Bible 366 times, one time for each day of the year. And, you know, God purposed to do that.
It's all about you.
On his morning job, Bob noticed an empty lot and kept noticing it until it hit him. It could be a baseball field. It could even be a Little League. The very Little League Hardball would later give attention to.
What do you do around here for fun?
Play baseball with you.
When the response proved too much to handle, Bob turned to his contacts in his growing insurance brokerage business. He made it clear to them he didn't just want their money. $700 for a team's uniforms, bats, and gloves. He wanted their time, too. And he wasn't going to take their money unless they coached in his Little League. Bob said, good men, married men, need to be there and set the examples. We have men that succeeded that I coached 13 years ago who are now back married with kids. These are the models.
The program has grown. We're the biggest inner city Little League in the country. So it's much more holistic. Baseball's just the carrot to attract kids. You need to do five little things as a neighbor. You need Boy Scouts. You need Little League. You need Bible study. You need the churches being active. And instead, everyone's thrown their hands up and gotten stun gun and thinking, this problem is too large for us. Let's go play 18 holes and write somebody a check and not get personally involved.
Bob says that if the boys are playing ball with each other when they're 11, it's hard for them to shoot each other at 16. That doesn't mean it's been all smiles for them.
I had one of my boys that I coached for years. He used to come to practice on his bike. He rode on the rims. And so one of the doctors that coaches with us, we bought him for his birthday. We got him new white wall tires and new handlebars and really snazzed his bike up. And I got a call from his grandmother a few weeks later I had to go get Ryan in the, at the morgue, go ID him. And I had shot him for his bike that we had brought him. So if you think we're going to win all the time, Mother Teresa said we're called to serve, not succeed. We're not going to win all these battles.
And yet the Muzikowskis kept going into battle. They thought, the Little League is a great first step. But we don't just want to apply bandages to open wounds. We want kids to have a more transforming experience that will change their whole future. Bob and Tina dreamed of starting a school where they could have hope for a better future. Their name for it? Chicago Hope Academy. A dream that would come true thanks to the generosity of volunteers and donors. The Muzikowskis themselves sold one half of their brokerage business to help finance it. And more importantly, invested their own kids into it.
I have seven children. Four of them are here at Hope. One of them graduated. If you want to fix the low-income urban schools, people with educations and money need to just put their own kids in the school with those kids.
At first, many didn't welcome the school, but it's been more than worthwhile.
When he started the school, there were death threats.
They threw bottles through our front windows and burned our garbage cans.
Some neighbors didn't appreciate that kids came from all over the city to attend Hope. Kids like William Mendez, who look up to Muzikowski as a provider.
Me and my mom was going through her second divorce, and it's basically down to a point where I was living in cars that weren't running and stuff. And Bob found out, unfortunately. He said, you know, there's no reason for you to do what you're doing. We've got rooms over here.
The students came to me and said, you got to talk to Will about his hygiene. And I talked to Will about that, and the fact of the matter, he's been living in a car. I stayed a couple nights in my basement, and then we moved him in here.
Muzikowski provides for lots of students.
Cortez Smith, kind of an ornery kid. We've become very close now, probably talk to him every day. He was shot on the way home from school early this year.
I turned around. I see a green car right past, and there was a lot of guys behind me, so they started shooting. The first bullet, first shot that went off, I got hit. I called Bob. He told me I could stay in a convent. So ever since then, I've just been staying here. Everything's been cool.
All that you've heard flows from this singular purpose of Bob's.
So my purpose is to hopefully honor God and have him say, well done, good and faithful servant, someday. I'm not that deep, you know.
Reporting for Our American Stories, I'm Alex Cortez.
Great work on that, Alex, and yeah, not that deep. The urgency of life on the west side of Chicago motivated Bob and Tina to join the Philanthropy Roundtable, the nation's leader in fostering excellence and generosity. Bob remarked, I'm looking for like-minded partners for advice and help. He continued, I hope to inspire people at the roundtable to give more and give with more intensity. And of course, he's hoping more people join the roundtable and more people give. And not just with their money, but with their time, with their hearts and their souls. Living generously. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. More after this.